Well, thank you for having me back. I think the last time I spoke here was almost 2 years ago now, maybe a year and a half ago. So it's wonderful to be back. Yeah. It's interesting because when Jeff emailed me, I was all excited. I'm like, great, I get to go back and I know exactly what I want to talk about. And so I shot back an email like, this is my topic. And then I realized, how am I going to talk about that? How am I going to convey what is oftentimes very subtle work with clients? And by that I mean, how do we translate our practice into our professional life? How do we actually live it? How does it inform every moment of what we do and how we make our decisions? So, as I often do, I kind of get worried and freak out, and then I build a scaffolding. I have this really neat outline about the paramitas and how they can be delivered to mindful business. But that doesn't really make a very good talk. I could send you all that outline, and that would be really nice, and you'd have just more ideas in your head about, wow, I can relate generosity to this, and I can relate effort to this. So what I want to do instead is what I do with clients, and that is really make this experiential. Of course, I'll be giving the talk. I'll be doing most of the talking, but I'm really going to ask you to do a lot of work today. Hopefully, it won't take too much effort, but it will take a lot of attention. So the first piece that comes to mind for me around translating our practice into sort of professional delivery is, what are we even talking about when we talk about mindfulness? That's not so easy to define. Of course, we have definitions from experts like Jon Kabat-Zinn and Daniel Goleman, and they'll tell us exactly what mindfulness should be. And those are all really valuable. But at the end of the day, what makes it ours? What makes our practice alive in a new way? So just take a minute. Just think about, like, if you've had a mindfulness practice for many years, or if this is your first time meditating, like, what is mindfulness? And maybe we'll just take about 30 seconds to reflect on that for yourself. It might come in words. It might not. Your definition might not even be in words. It might be in an experience or a feeling. Like, what is this thing we're even talking about? Now, maybe something came. Maybe you went looking for something. Notice the tendency of the mind to go looking for something instead of allowing something to come. If you ever want to see your mind really go looking for something, just sit in meditation before you're going to give a speech. Your mind will go looking for the speech. My mind probably had 30 different versions. So does your mind go looking for mindfulness? Or do you let yourself discover mindfulness? Because if it's available, it's available, right? So I'll start with sort of my definition. And of course, there's no right definition. It's about a relationship that you have with it. But for me, it usually is something like sensitive to the subtle. Like, if I say something that's really offensive in this speech, I'll get feedback, right? I'll see looks on faces. It'll be clear. But if I'm not getting that relational feedback, I'm not sensitive to the subtle. And then I got to be more obviously offensive to get the feedback. So maybe somebody else. You can just speak your truth. What is mindfulness? What's your way of relating? Please.
Paying attention.
Paying attention. Beautiful.
Loving awareness.
Loving awareness. Thanks.
Watching.
Watching.
Realigning where my mind is with my body.
So that mind-body connection. Thank you. Anyone else?
I'd say being instead of doing.
Being instead of doing. Thank you. So which one of those answers is right? Of course, they all are. And so then we take that, we take our relationship to mindfulness, and we use it to clarify what I like to call values, decision making. So how do we know, for instance, and again, I'm using this mostly in relation to professional decisions because that's where I'm working these days, but how do we know whether $100,000 is good or not? You know, to one person that's like, oh my gosh, I'm rich, $100,000. For another person it's like, okay, that's a third of my portion, but where's the rest? And so how do we come to that? Well, it's not just as easy as doing the math and saying, oh, I like bigger numbers. I don't like smaller numbers. It's about really checking in fully and saying, well, given my life situation, all the things that come to bear, all of my responsibilities, everything that is my life, do I have family support, do I not? How do I situate in this moment? And how do you find that out? There's so many details that you could spend a whole lifetime trying to figure it out. Or you could sit in mindful awareness and get really clear about what feels right to you and good to you, and then move from that place. You know, I don't know how many times I've talked to someone who's going into a negotiation and has no idea what they'd even like. They don't even know what they want. And then when they're in there, of course, decisions sometimes need to be made quickly, and it's just like they walk out of there feeling good and for about 25 minutes, and then they realize, actually, this is only going to make me feel good for about a week. And then when it comes back full circle, this isn't going to work. Like, this isn't possible for me. And so only if we're in mindfulness can we really feel when, I can feel how that will be okay for a couple years or 3 years. So mindfulness is this capacity, like some of you said, to be present, but also to see sort of globally beyond the present. Something else happens when we're mindful. All of a sudden, decisions get easier, not because they're easy decisions, but because we know our center, we know where we are, so our rudder for making these decisions, we have a lot of what's called efficacy, like the little train that could, I think I can, we start to know we can. And so we get confident. Like if you've ever seen a child learning a skill, when they know they can hit the ball, all of a sudden they light up. Before they were really sort of down on themselves, and then as soon as they make contact, I teach Little League Baseball, so I see it all the time, like, oh, they make contact, and it doesn't even have to be good contact, it's just like a foul tip or something, they're just like, it's possible to hit that thing. And so the same is true for each of us when we have self-doubt or we have challenges or we're not sure around what our professional value is. And that all comes out of our personal values. You know, I saw a sign, I think I was driving this morning here, and I saw a sign that's just like, how do you let go? Or maybe it was in a LinkedIn article. How do you let go? Sure, letting go is great and being free is great, but how do you do it? Well, what I've learned and what I've experienced in my own practice is that awareness is self-liberating. When I see that I'm hurting myself by holding on, I don't then have to pry the hand open, metaphorically. It's like if I'm holding a burning ball, you just let go of it. And so the same is true in how we relate and make choices based on our values. When we feel like, oh, this value that I'm sort of not serving me anymore doesn't feel right, it just happens. And if it doesn't just happen, maybe we're not seeing it quite yet. And that's okay too. So when we're rooted in our personal values, they translate seamlessly, unless there's something in the way, right? Unless there's something conflicting with the values. Unless there's some conditioning, probably from our culture, right? That, Oh, I can't really. I mean, it's so interesting. If I don't know if any of you are reading about mindfulness in business these days, but there really is a new wave where sort of homegrown engagement of business is really starting to come back. It's really beautiful to see. Even in these mega corporations, people just want honesty. They just want, but how do you get that in a business, or how do you create a culture externally unless we have it internally? And again, some of you might be business people and some of you might not be, but even if you're like a sole proprietor, how do you set your fees? Just by seeing what's out there? Well, what if it out there is all based on working 40-hour work weeks and you only want to work a 10-hour work week? You're just going to pick that number because that's what people will pay and that's what's right for everybody else? Or do you go inside and feel what's right for you and what vision works for you? Like, oh, maybe I'd like to work 4 hours a day instead of 12. Is that possible? Maybe I want to work, I mean, to use sort of the ridiculous extreme, what if you wanted to work 1 hour a year? Hmm. Can you sell your services to make enough 1 hour a year? Probably not. Be kind of cool if you could. Some people probably can. I don't know. But so designing it, and the only way to sort of come to what you want is to sit with that. What life do I want? I often with my clients work on what's your perfect day? Do you want to be able to do yoga today? Do you want to be able to like spend time with your family today? Or are those just going to be special days, like when you're on vacation or maybe once in a while on the weekend? Or can your perfect day be every day? And so how to clarify values around, well, how am I going to sort of massage this life so I'm taking care of myself? I have a policy with clients, and I'm using a lot of client examples because I think it's helpful, where if the client calls after 10 minutes, it's a forfeited session. I wait 10 minutes. And he called at like 11 minutes. Of course, they always do, like 1 minute late. And so I said, no, the session's forfeited. And he was very upset with me because he pays good money to have sessions. And we processed it a little bit, and I said, let's talk next week because that's his next session. He called back. He was on time. And I said, you're angry at me, aren't you? He's like, yeah, I'm very angry at you. It's a waste of money. And so what I did is I said, how are you when your clients call? He's like, I pick up the phone immediately. I'm like, how's that working for you? He goes, I hate it. I'm like, why is that? Because I don't feel like I have any space for myself. I'm just reacting to the phone basically all day long. And so I said, you probably would have been happy if I would have made an exception for you, but would you have grown? Would you have received the services you approached me for? And there was no other explanation needed. And so how to do that for ourselves, how to take care of ourselves, discover our values in our mindfulness practice, and then let that ripple out into our interactions and how we want to live. And it's funny because for many years I was more in the spiritual life coach domain. And then I sort of came into this because at some point it was like, what does it mean to be spiritual and alive? And I thought, I do a lot of my life is working. And I'd like to be spiritual and alive in my work. I don't want it to be like, well, now I get to do my formal sit and the rest of the day is just chaos. No, I wanted something seamless to unfold. Again, personal value translated to professional value, and then around this crazy concept the world has around money, around conceptual value. I like to think of money as energy made physical. It's just a way for us to say, here's certain number of hours of my time and I'll take a few hours of your time in a piece of paper. So again, for my own sort of transformation and work around this, it's like, oh, what are my family beliefs around money? And how can my practice engage in this conceptual, conventional reality and still stay rooted in something ultimate, something that I can take refuge in, something that doesn't get touched by the fact that we do this all the time? Because the Dharma doesn't exist in the law of exchange. It's not about give and take as its essence. It's about there's a safe place, that there's something almost unchanging about it. And so how can I be steadfast when I'm in a world that is something other than steadfast at times? And then how can I translate that inner relationship to being a good negotiator where both parties come away feeling good, whether that's in business or whether that's in love or whether that's in how we relate to animals or the environment? How can I have a value-based relationship with a flower? And how can that be commerce too? How can I set my fees so I really feel like it's okay? I'm authentic, but I'm also fully supported. My wife's a yoga teacher, and so I tell her, I said, hey, you know, they pay the premium because they're paying for you not to have to go get a full-time job. You're available whenever they want you. So they have to cover the fact that you can't go get a full-time job or they lose the service. And so how do you come to terms with that when you're a service-based provider? Or how do you negotiate a salary with one client who doesn't want to say no, so he says yes? And in negotiations, he just gets whatever he's offered. So I'm trying to teach him at least to say maybe. Mm-hmm. Like at least step back a little bit and see what else is available. But again, only by being in our practice and by really feeling our own value as a being can we say my life is worth what it's worth. And this is how I want to live. I want time to meditate every day. I want time to do yoga every day. I want time to play catch with my son every day. How can I create that? And then whatever you want, whatever your values are, whether they're tangible or whether they're ideological. Notice how this sits in your body. Again, it's not just about me telling you something. I think I was introduced as a teacher. I've learned over the last 20 years to not be a teacher. Not that teachers are bad, but that I'd much rather be a friend. Teacher's a lot of pressure. So notice how this sits in your body. What are my values? Are my values connected to my work? How are they connected? Did my work grow out of my worldview and what I want for myself and others in the world? I just read an interesting article about a medical device company who, connecting all of the employees to the common goal, which the common goal is keeping people alive, keeping them healthy. So even the person on the assembly line that just, you know, puts the plastic tube in the thing all day long, if they can really connect to that higher purpose, that 5,000 people aren't going to die this year because I do this, that person, all of a sudden, we've all heard the bricklayer at the pyramid, you know, there's three ways to engage in that. One guy says, you know, I'm cutting this goddamn stone all day. And the other person says, oh, we're building these pyramids that are going to be a place for our king to live. And then the third person says, I'm building a temple to God. And so that person that values life, doesn't matter how mundane, they're keeping 5,000 families from losing, you know, somebody they love. And the ripple effect of that, of course, is endless, because those families probably have 60 people each extended. And then, of course, the Buddhist teaching of interconnectedness. How do I know that everything that I say here today will have some effect, either positive or negative? Or neutral, potentially, but unlikely. So how do I give great care? How do I say what I think is most important about the topic that I've chosen, or about anything? And how do I respect you and honor your suffering by letting you suffer a little bit? You know, there's part of me that wants to make this talk a little more fun. Like, well, but this is hard stuff. Like, wow, how have I done it? And if I haven't done it consciously or chosen deliberately, how would I like to do it moving forward? Either my personal or my professional, or bringing the line together. Part of the reason my work has taken the expression that it's taken is I, after about 10 years, recognized that my number of friends was dwindling, that I was spending all my time working. And I thought, how is this going to work out? By the time I'm 60, I'll have no friends at this rate. And so I said, that's no good. Like, I want all my time to be social time, even my work. I want it all to be relating to people. How do you want to do it? How do you want to share resources? Those that you have and those that you can create, and maybe never have, but be a conduit or a portal to translate resources. Again, that interconnected piece. You know, some of you might be in very powerful positions. How do I want to do that? What do I want my legacy to be? What is the purpose of what we're doing? What does the market need? But also, what is the need need? What does the world need? What does the world need? And the world need? Let's pair up. Let's find a partner. So just, and somebody that you don't really know, not your best friend. Like, find somebody you don't know. Just go over and say, hey, I want to partner with you. This is going to be awkward. Fantastic. And then what we're going to do, what we'll do, is we're going to talk about what we want our professional legacy to be. So we're going to spend about 2 or 3 minutes, and we're just going to share what we would like our professional legacy to be, and include what you want people to say about you when you're gone. What you'd like people to say about you when you're gone. And connect it in some way to your own inner practice. I don't know how you're going to do that. Good luck. Let's start to bring it back. Bring it back. Anybody not like talking about their work? That's good information, right? What was that like? Let's just, anyone who wants to share, what was that like?
Well, in the conversation, I'd sort of forgotten that I actually accomplished something that I wanted to and went in the directions that I decided on when I was, not realizing I was doing that when I was 17, one of which had a downside. So that was interesting.
So it's interesting because the translation of mindfulness or sati is things remembered, sort of in the classical language, which there's that reflective capacity, and it's not just remembering like the mind remembers, but also this respecting or reflecting again, so we can metabolize it and embody it. So it sounds like some of that sort of happened, like, oh, remembering that sort of closed a loop maybe for you. Anyone else? What was that like for you?
Well, I was talking to
Roy.
Yeah, I was telling Roy that I just went back to technology. I took a job at Salesforce, and the last month has been kind of miserable. And I was telling him my happiness is not worth the money I'm getting. So I was telling him some of the alternatives I was thinking about was going back to New York to take care of my mom, whose health is not doing so well. He has a experience of that. He actually did what I told him I was going to do with his mom. And he encouraged me to explore that option.
Wow, so that's great. So that's the social piece, right? We connect around the values that are important to us. And there's always these competing values. And so how do you make that decision whether to stay or not stay? Whether to transition or not transition. And only by sort of really taking stock, like what's most important right now in my life, can you make these really difficult decisions? Like, I mean, I have a similar story. I mean, my dad has cancer. I was offered a really nice job, but it was, well, I want to be available if need. So maybe I'll make a little less money working on my own. But then I'm totally available if there's an emergency. So it's we're always taking stock, and mindfulness, our practice, is what helps us make these seemingly sometimes impossible decisions.
It's certainly not uncommon to be asked to think about what we want our legacy to be and what we want other people to think of us when we're gone. You know, even Stephen Covey, the first of the seven, what was it called? Seven habits of, you know, it's a begin with the end in mind, you know, and act the way that you want to be perceived at the end. But how that links into my practice is not to care what other people think about me or are going to think about me. So that seemed to be at odds right there.
Well, so that's a great recognition for you, that those feel at odds for you, and that legacy for you is how people perceive you. Other people might define legacy differently.
You know, I've started regarding myself as a senior citizen with a lot of perspective to give to younger folks on their careers, and I don't know how that happened, but anyway, but my experience in my own career has always been to make a lemonade out of a lemon and not walk away from something when it feels like it's still a lemon. I have found that to be tremendously helpful for me, not walking away from a bad situation, but to at least walk away from it feeling like you've achieved something.
Hmm. Does that tie into your personal practice in some way? Is that the connection that you're making, or is there some other piece around personal practice in there?
I think in a work situation you're inevitably going to run into challenges that seem almost insurmountable. That you're going to run into relationships that aren't just not working at all for you, and a lot of times that is not clear why that's happening. It's just not sure. But I know that for myself, I have this point of view that through time, these things will work themselves out if I have that intention for them to work out, at least with a sense of integrity. So it's hard to know exactly how that's going to happen, but I've had a situation in my own professional life, I've often wanted to just leave, quit, and walk away from something because it just seems impossible. But my experience has been that the fact that I've stayed and worked through some difficult time, it has proven to be to my benefit.
That for me sort of echoes of the paramita of integrity and that capacity to sort of stay the course, at least until it's better. You don't have to stay the course forever, but at least until, I mean, and again, in my short life, I've even seen where I grew up when a toaster was broken, you fixed it. Now a toaster's broken, it's not worth your time to fix it, right? You throw it away and you go buy another one because they're so cheap. But that's a really different way of approaching is, no, we don't trash it, we work on it. We fix the bicycle until it's beyond, you know, whatever. So we take things to the next stage. I really like that. Thank you. Anyone else, what the experience was like?
Well, your talk put me in mind of how pretty early in my life I encountered the story of how above the Oracle of Delphus was engraved the words, "Know thyself." And I always puzzled over that, and for the next 50 years I've thought about it, and my practice has helped me understand what that's about. And it actually works on so many levels. But it also helped me a lot in my career in the fact that if you really know who you are and what you need and what you can give to something, it's so much easier to make a decision about where you're going to move in your career and how you're going to relate to other people and what's going to be most valuable to you when you do whatever work you're trying to do. And in terms of legacy, I realized that my hope for whatever legacy I might have is that people remember me as someone who helped smooth the way for other people to do their work and to help make the end result of whatever we worked on the best it could be. And that's more of a kind of legacy that I'm interested in than financial or fame or anything like that.
Thank you.
And also it related to the Buddhist right livelihood. You know, that's another thing. How do you know it's right? And you only know it's right if you know yourself and you have a clear channel, you know, with your through your practice.
Well, thank you. I mean, a legacy could be to leave zero footprint. You know, that could be a beautiful legacy to have. Like, there's no evidence that I was even here. It's like the teacher Nisargadatta talks about the piece of incense burning. Right effort is like when a piece of incense burns and there's no incense left, just a nice smell in the air. And so how can we, that might be the legacy we want to live. It's like, oh, it's just better off. But there's almost no indication that I was here. Anyone else? Please.
So your talk brought up a lot of stuff for me. I left corporate America finance about 7 or 8 years ago to become a classroom teacher, which feels right for me. And and I feel like this practice has helped me in my classroom, and I teach kindergarten, and I'm starting to meditate with them. But what you said, teaching now has taken over my whole life. and I don't. I'm losing friends. I'm losing social. I mean, I socialize with the kids all day, but they're five, so
they're not going to go out for drinks.
So I need to bring some mindfulness back into. So I think my legacy. I think I realized, like, I want my legacy to be like he cared about me, whether it be my students, the teachers, the parents, my neighborhood, whatever, that he cared about me or cared about things. And but then ironically, I'm not taking very good care of myself. Like, what about I care about me kind of thing. So bringing more mindfulness back into that. Okay, so I feel like I'm in the right livelihood. I feel like I'm working on that legacy. But then let's turn that mindfulness back on self and self-care.
When, as a teacher, I mean, I've heard lots of stories. Like, it's a really hard job. Because you're preparing, you're giving, and how do you sort of complete the loop so you have enough financial resources, so you have enough free time? It's a delicate balance. Thank you.
It was funny when you mentioned legacy, I immediately got a visceral response. I don't even like that word. It seems to me to seem ego-driven, looking back, making judgment. And it seems like so much of what I try to do is kind of be in the present and be mindful and skillful and handle each thing. I try not to go. I've been retired a long time, and I try not to go back there. Today is, we have to plan. I just wanted to throw that out there. I had that reaction.
So again, that's just information. It's like, okay, this word has this feeling for me and. You know, there's an element of our practice that is deconstructing. We see insight is pulls things apart so you can see in the spaces, but then our practice also has this a synthesizing component where things like metta and compassion practice sort of hold us in more of a holistic way. So we want both. We want our practice to have both. I know for the first 10 years I practiced, it was all insight. I wanted to get enlightened. And then I was like, oh, well, now I'm just... Sure, I've had great insights, but now I'm just intolerable to be around. And so I asked my teacher, I said, well, what do I need? Give me something good. And he said, about 10 years of loving kindness practice now. And I said, oh, that's great. That's not very long at all. And he said, actually, I was just kidding. 15 years. I said, okay, well, that's okay too. But how do we make a strong practice, a robust container, not just really sharp? Like, I mean, I've heard it said, like, oh, mindfulness, does that mean like a sniper can be mindful? Well, if you have a cognitive version of mindfulness, sure. If mindfulness is just focus, but it's not just focus. It's not just concentration in the narrowing sense, it's concentration in a full sense. Like, I can sort of feel the wall behind me even though I can't see it. Not like laser beam focus on it. Or I like the phrase diffuse focus. When we're watching like pain in the hip and we're sitting there and it's really bad, it doesn't really help to just like fixate on it, but I just want sort of a global, I care about you awareness. I notice you. I really want you to stop doing that, but if you have to, that's fine. Awareness. Anyone else want to mention their experience in the... Anyone want to mention the piece of, this is how my legacy might be tied to my personal practice? Anyone have anything come out of that?
Mine actually, it was very useful for me. I've been sort of going through a period of self-doubt and reminding me how much my work is inherently tied to it as somebody who's got a real devotional practice, that as somebody who does counseling and psychotherapy, I related to the story about the pyramid. I'm building temple for God. So it helped me reconnect with that I'm on the right path. So I appreciate it in that way.
That's kind of how it was for me too. It's how can my practice and my work be an expression of my practice so it can be seamless? Much of my career coaching work with folks is just to use myself as an example. Like, this is what I had to go through. I spent, you know, 10 years as a full-time meditation teacher and loved the spaciousness around the schedule, but didn't have the financial resources to raise my family. And so how could I translate? And I didn't want to go get new skills. I didn't want to go, like, learn programming or something like that. Nothing against programmers.
Right.
But I didn't want to do that. And so how do I translate my skill set in a way that I can be in alignment with my deepest spirituality and just be delivering it in that way?